What do you feel is humanity's purpose? You actually have proposed something that I absolutely love. You call it the Department of Peace. What are some practical steps and policies for this department that you would implement? What are some practical ways that you can kind of go into the root of some of our issues? You have spent your career, your entire life, really, serving individuals, groups, and communities with your books, with your speeches. So I just want to ask you, how do you respond when people say, yeah, she's got good ideas, but I don't know if she has the experience necessary? So welcome, guys, to another episode of Sauna Sessions. Today, we have a very, very special guest. You are going to love this. This is someone that I have known about for almost a decade, just through books, through speeches, talks, from Oprah to Deepak to Wayne Dyer. She's just an incredible human being, a humanitarian, and a presidential candidate. And before I tell you who it is, you may have heard the quote that is so world famous and has impacted and transformed so many people's lives. The quote is, our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. So that quote comes from our guest today, Marianne Williamson. Welcome, Marianne. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great. And thank you so much for your words and for having me.
We're happy to have you. You know, I know you're very busy. You're on the move. You're on the journey. How's everything going? How's the campaign going? How are things these days?
It's an exhilarating experience and a brutal experience. A variety of emotional experiences, ups and downs. But that's what makes it such a challenge at being everything that you feel you can be in your life. Rising above, staying focused, being intentional, having a thick skin but an open heart. So I'm going through everything that I think I need to go through as a human being. And in order to be of best service, you know, just in case I win, I can totally see that a campaign prepares you for the job. You know, every once in a while when it's really hard, I think, well, you think this is hard, try being president. And you go, yeah, I understand that this is, you think they're after you now, wait till you're president. You know, so that's how I feel about it.
Well, what was the moment? Was there a moment? Was this something inside of you as a little girl that you wanted to be president?
No, nothing like that. Although when I ran in 2020, it really was an instant of impulse. I'm running for president. It was kind of extraordinary. This was different this time because running a second time, I was no longer naive about what it entails. The image I had was you're going to be running into a burning building. But then I had this image of, yeah, but you're going to be filled with this white powder that's like a fire retardant inside, you know, that only God can provide. You know that you'll be able to withstand the fire of the smears and the insults. And really, it's an online abuse. And I don't think that's just me. I think that's any political candidate. We're just living in a very mean moment, in a very mean-spirited moment. So it took a while, a lot of deep consideration to decide to run this time. But if I had not run, I think I'd just be screaming at TV all the time. And I think I would live the rest of my life with this nagging sense of what might have been. So regardless where this goes, I will know I left it all on the field. And I will be able to know that I was in the arena. May that open up to victory, but the victory is also in the process. I read a quote somewhere once, to be fully invested in an effort and unattached to the results. That's what I try to practice.
Mm. That's very Taoist too, you know, not being attached to the fruits. I mean, this is the way to live without really suffering. The pain's going to happen, but the suffering is optional.
And at the same time, if somebody's investing their money in your campaign, you owe it to them to do this to win. So it's a little bit of a paradox, but I had an experience just this morning because sometimes it really does take you down. It's a very difficult experience. And in my case, there's a whole machine dedicated to peripheralizing my candidacy, marginalizing it, smearing me, erasing me, invisible. I mean, it's so this just this morning, having been through this for hours and, you know, trying to discern, you know, whatever the meaning is, it's like this. If you allow it to, it can be quicksand. just emotional and psychological quicksand. It can just take you down into a sense of hopelessness and no way, and the system's locked up and I failed and blah, blah, blah. You can go there. And then I had this image of like coming like almost like a swimmer. It's you know. And I got, what is my goal? My goal is to be a person big enough to just go, challenge. I want to be a person big enough. You know, you can't always control what happens in your life, but you can control who you choose to be in the midst of the experience. And I think that's where we are as a nation. It's where we are as individuals. It's always where we are in life. Circumstances are what circumstances are. But who are you? Are you in a position not only to endure, but to transform the circumstances that need transformation? So that's what I got. I want to be a person who's like, this is cool all the time. Rather, you know, when I'm out there speaking to audiences, it is cool. It's exhilarating. It's wonderful. I love it. I love the experience. It's what happens. There are two universes. There's the universe of talking to the voters, which is what democracy should be about. And that's incredible because the American people, what I've learned from all this, the American people are not the problem. The American people are decent and open and kind of amazing. And it's a privilege and a blessing and an exhilarating experience to be out there on the campaign trail. But then there's another universe, the money, the machine, the DNC, the ways you get blocked, the ways they won't have you on media, the way you're blackballed, the way you're misrepresented, the way you're mischaracterized. I call it the political media industrial complex. So are you going to go up and then down and then up and then down? Or can you achieve, like you were talking about Buddhism before, can you achieve a state of such equanimity that, yeah, I can be cool with the good stuff, but I can also write out the other stuff. So that's my goal. I'm not there 100%. But I know that that's the challenge. And like I said, that would be the challenge if you're president of the United States as well. Not every day would be a pleasant day.
You know, that's interesting. So I think it's the toughest job, you know, to have. I mean, running the campaign and having to deal with so much criticism. What do you do to stay centered? My philosophy is, and I always come back to this, and it's very simple, but it provides me with a lot of comfort in tough times, and that is, all is well and unfolding as it should, right? I know I was watching some interviews, you back in, I think it was university, you used to study Ram Dass. And then you said later it would be like the anti-war content. One of my favorite quotes from Ram Dass is, he said something very similar. He said, the world is perfect as it is, and so is my desire to want to heal it. And it's like not a paradox, it's something that goes beyond concept and an idea. It's an essence, a presence that I think, a surrender that you maintain that, yeah, all is, things might be crazy right now, but at some level, it's all going according to plan. And I also have work to do to try to fix it.
A couple of things come up for me. First of all, I think of the universe as self-correcting. So when things deviate from love and deviate from divine perfection because of human free will, it's kind of like when you're in a car and it starts to go out of control. And what we were all taught when we were learning how to drive, take your hands off the wheel. It will right itself. So things are perfect. Even the moments when they're not perfect, perfection will bring it back to perfection. But that's when you have to step back rather than get in there with your self-will, because somebody's self-will was what caused it to swerve to begin with. Also, there's an old rabbinical saying, you are not expected to complete the task, but neither are you permitted to abandon it. So there's this sense that only if you're attached to everything being made perfect in your lifetime, is there really a problem here? So as long as you know that if you do your best and appreciate that millions and millions and millions of people are showing up to doing their best, and that we're all part of this matrix of healing and improvement, then you can rest assured this thing is going according to plan, even if I don't know what the plan is. And ultimately, because love will prevail, the only real question is how much human suffering and how much other species suffering will occur before love prevails. Love will prevail. The moral arc of the universe is long, but it does bend towards justice. The urgency is, can we jump to the loving part without going through all the suffering that will otherwise result? And I think that that's exactly where we are as a species right now. We're going to get there. We're going to change. Things are going to change. Things are not going to remain the same. Anybody with any sense of discernment regarding the energy on the planet right now, the rumblings underneath the surface, this is going to blow. This is going to erupt. We're not going to be able to keep the lid on it, but it's up to us. Is it going to fall in the direction of greater democracy, greater justice, greater brotherhood and love? Or is it going to go first into greater chaos, dystopia, and God knows what else? So I think we can see ourselves as birth doulas, midwives to a world that is struggling to be born, knowing that if we don't do that, the other world is still going to die, but let it be a peaceful rather than a violent death.
Wow, so well said. Actually, let me play devil's advocate for a minute.
Like the devil needs an advocate. I love that phrase. Like the devil doesn't have enough people taking up for him these days.
So love is who we are. I feel at our core. I believe that love is the most powerful force on this planet. It even defies mathematics, right? It's the only thing that multiplies when it is divided. But I want to ask you, in the world, we do see a lot of fear. The fear seems to be in control. There's a man named Roger Stone. I'm sure you're familiar with him. He was one of Trump's advisors. And he actually took, a lot of people don't know this, he suggested that Trump take a slogan from Reagan back in the 80s. And that slogan was, "Make America Great Again." And in his book, in Roger Stone's book, Stone Rules, he says something that I'd love to get your take on. He says, hate is a stronger motivator than love. He said, people feel satisfied when there is something they can vote for, but they feel exhilarated when there is something that they can vote against. How did you respond to that one?
Yeah, fascists believe that, and fascists figured that out a long time ago. So this is the deal. It's the difference between white sugar and healthy food. White sugar, and that hatred, it gives you an immediate high, an immediate, anger. Anger is a political motivator. It gives you an immediate high. There will be a crash, however. If you're really doing it for love, it nourishes you and turns you into the person you need to be. You might not get to first base fastest, but you will win. Now, Jared Kushner, I read an interview, I think it was in Rolling Stone magazine with Jared Kushner. I'm still stuck on the fact that you read Roger Stone's book. I'm like, what's he read Roger Stone's book? But it's good because you got those quotes. You got to know it all. Okay, but hold on a second. So this was in a Rolling Stone interview, I believe, and it was with Jared Kushner. And Jared Kushner said that he had been at a McDonald's, of all places, with his father-in-law. And he looked around and he said, there are a lot of angry people out there. We could harness all that and make you president. Now, to me, that's the most cynical statement that I can even imagine. However, that's exactly what they did. I want to try to harness love in order to change the world. It's been done before. So Roger Stone history proves him wrong. The two most powerful revolutions of the 20th century were both nonviolent revolutions, the Indian independence movement and the civil rights movement in the United States. So we actually do have examples and evidence of what love can do. Not even to mention the obvious fact that hate will only destroy us all. It's not even at this point a sustainable option. It will destroy our democracy if we go with hate. At this point, destroy the world if we go with hate. So there must be a better way.
I love how you also say love. You know, people are hating with conviction. We must love with conviction.
That's exactly the point. That is exactly the point. And so I think, Roger, listen, I think what he said there was a lot to look at there. Because it is true, it inspires more immediate conviction. But love, you know, it's interesting. I have a new granddaughter, and my daughter's mother-in-law, I had said to her something like, all I want to do is just look at the baby. And she said, yeah, we're granny gazing. And I said to her, I don't remember when my daughter was born to spending this much time just staring at her. She said, that's because when you have a child, you're so busy feeding them, dressing them, bathing them, making sure they get whatever, you know, baby, you're busy when you're a new parent. Whereas when you, by the time you're a grandparent, you're just so amazed by the miracle of it all. I assure you, the way any of us, do you have children? The way any of us look at our children, and hopefully get to the point where we would look at other people's children as well, we would do anything for them. There's no hate that could motivate me as much as my desire to create a world where she would be safe.
Wow, beautiful, beautiful. You know, it bugs me sometimes when I hear people say, oh yeah, but you know, she's got, Marianne, she's got good ideas, but she doesn't have political experience. You know, when I look at politics, I don't look at it like some people look at it, of the corporation, you know, by the corporation, for the corporation. I look at it as it should be looked at, of the people, by the people, for the people, right? And I feel like the meaning of politics is genuinely, and you said this earlier, is to serve. And you have spent your career, your entire life, really serving individuals, groups, and communities with your books, with your speeches. So I just want to ask you, how do you respond when people say, yeah, she's got good ideas, but I don't know if she has the experience necessary?
Yeah, so let's look at that. First of all, whoever says that is very naive about how most politicians spend their time, because half the time it's on the phone raising money. That's number one. Number two, very experienced politicians led us into the Vietnam War. Very experienced politicians led us into the Iraq War. Very experienced politicians kept us in Afghanistan 20 years too long. Very experienced politicians have brought us to where we are, and we are 6 inches from the cliff. We're 6 inches from the cliff in terms of the state of our democracy, in terms of the state of our environment, and in terms of the state of the planet itself. What have all these experienced politicians done? So, of course, they've created that narrative, which people sort of repeat in this trance-like way, because what they're saying is, I'm not a political car mechanic. So the way I respond is, the problem is not that we don't have enough car mechanics in Washington. We have plenty of them. You hire them. The problem is we're on the wrong road. So this is not, I'm not a political car mechanic, but I have an idea what road we should be on. And the road we should be on is turning around now, is a U-turn. And all these experienced politicians, what they're experienced in is perpetuating the system as it is, continuing to drive in the direction we're driving, because that has been their experience, and that almost disqualifies them. They can't see the forest through the trees. So someone from outside that system says, excuse me, you're on the wrong road. And they say, but this is a Bentley. And I don't care. You're on the wrong road. So, you know, so that's what I say to that. I have a couple of other things to say. Franklin Roosevelt said the most important job of the president is not administrative. It's moral leadership. I don't care how much experience you have. If you will allow a child to go hungry in the richest country in the world, you should not be in that office as far as I'm concerned. I don't care how much experience you have. If you are not doing everything you can all day, every day to deal with the fact that 62% of Americans live paycheck to paycheck, or the fact that the planet is imploding because we're still ramping up fossil fuel extraction, or you are still seeing wars and prison as the primary problem solver to problems that are actually created by a reliance on brute force to begin with, you should not be there. So I think someone who like gets that, it's almost like that is my qualification. That, you know, she has no political experience, which by the way, neither did Donald Trump. And by the way, they're not saying that so much about Cornel West. They're not saying that so much about Bobby Kennedy. They didn't even say it about Ralph Nader. Gee, I wonder what the difference is there. And I think that the experience I have had is what makes me, if I may say so, uniquely prepared for this moment. And I also think it's really interesting how in the Constitution, there are various places in the Constitution where what is not said is as interesting as what is said. So the founder said that the president had to have been born here, 35 or older, and had lived here for 14 years. I think it's very interesting that it does not say had to have been a governor, or a senator, or a congressman. They were leaving it to every generation to decide for itself. What do you think is the skill set required for this moment? The political system that we have is so ensconced in 20th century thinking. We have a lot of 21st century problems created by 21st century thinking. It's that Einstein quote, we will not solve the problems of the world from the level of thinking we were at when we created them. So I come in with a different kind of mindset, which, by the way, is why I think my campaign is popular with young people. Because Gen Z is not even 20th century people. They have a much more holistic, whole person perspective on life because that's much more the 21st century mindset. And there are some very good people in Washington and some people who are really trying to fight the good fight within the system as it is. Yes, there are, obviously. However, there's something, people get sucked into something. Well, it has to be, or we have to go slow, or we have to not piss off the insurance companies so much that they'll primary us, or the pharmaceutical companies, or the gun manufacturers, or big food, or big chemical companies, or big ag, or defense contractors, or big oil. If you're not ready to just cut the cord with the aberrational chapter of American history that produced that kind of corporate tyranny, then I don't care how much experience you've had at trying to negotiate that. The person whose experience will allow us to cut the cord with that is someone who simply doesn't care about those arrangements and knows we need to end one chapter of American history and begin a new one.
Well said. Yeah, it kind of has to come from an outsider. You know, the whole business as usual, profit over people mentality, I think we're tired of it. Again, why you're probably seeing a lot of, you know, Gen Z and millennials supporting your campaign is because we're kind of waking up and we haven't been as, I'll say this, brainwashed by the system for as long a time as I think the older generations have. So I love that. I love that you're thinking about moral leadership. There was in your book, you had a quote and you said, our government has become a system of legalized bribery, less concerned with deep issues of humanity's purpose and more with shallow questions of money and power. What do you feel is humanity's purpose?
To love and to be loved. You were talking before about how love is who and what we are. And I think the purpose of our lives is to manifest on earth the love that is in our hearts. And the tragedy of the world is the gap between the two. And closing the gap is the purpose of our existence. But first we have to close it. You know, it's an inside as well as outside job, because even closing it within ourselves. And I think we have to close it within ourselves before, you know, when Gandhi said you must be the change, well, everything you do is infused with the consciousness with which you do it. So if I haven't closed the gap within myself, then I have limited power to effectuate the closing of the gap in the world. And that's why the inner work is every bit as relevant as the changes we're trying to effectuate outside, because consciousness is the level of cause. And if we only treat the symptoms, then the cause will just turn into a different form and it will reappear. And that right there is the difference between 20th and 21st century thinking. In the 21st century, we realize we have to address root causes, or the symptoms will simply be eradicated temporarily, suppressed temporarily, and then appear again in another form.
What are some practical ways that you can kind of go into the root of some of our issues, which, you know, which you said about the individual turning within? How would you kind of, if you were president, what would you do to kind of impact that?
Well, there are many different ways that people seek the light within. Some are religious, some are spiritual, some are psychotherapeutic, but within a secular context, there's no right or wrong there. But many people are realizing, you know, going back to this 20th versus 21st century mindset, the 20th century mindset was very mechanistic. It was very concerned with the outer miasma of machinery and industrialization and the scientific revolution, and too often at the expense of a sense of inner dynamic, psychological, emotional, spiritual. The world is seeking to balance itself now. And once again, some people through religion, some people through spirituality, some people, you know, they don't contextualize it with words like that. But they know that when they close their eyes and seek quiet, that's why people talk about mindfulness, because you can talk about mindfulness and it doesn't have to trigger you with words. It's the same stuff though, right? So that is a revolution in consciousness that is going on the planet right now. And for me, as much as for millions and millions and millions of other people, that's a way to start my morning. Because, you know, just like when you wake up in the morning, you take a shower, you take a bath, you brush your teeth, you don't want to take yesterday's dirt with you into the world on your body. But if you do not prepare yourself, sort of ground your being in a more peaceful place in the morning particularly, then you might have it all together outside, but you're carrying yesterday's stress. And particularly this time, it's not only your stress, it's the stress of every Israeli and Palestinian. You know, there's just so much stress on the planet. So modernity is an assault on our nervous system. And it takes work to prepare yourself to dwell within this time without it defeating you. That's why that work is so important, because people are feeling beaten down. People are spiraling down right now. I'm sure you see it. You're sensitive to all. I mean, people are spiraling down, and it's too important. We have to show up. And I know for myself, a lot of it, I love history. And when you look at what the abolitionists did, and you look at what the women's suffragists did, and you look at what the early labor organizers did, and you look at what the civil rights movement did, and no matter who we are ethnically, racially, look at what your ancestors did, then it really does say, toughen up, buttercup. Your ancestors stood up and they rose to this challenge. It's not any worse now than evils in the past. And rise up. At a certain point, you cry, you process, and then you get up and you get dressed and you get out there and help change the world.
What's your morning practice? You mentioned when you get up in the morning. Is there something specific that you do that you could share?
I am a student of A Course in Miracles. I also have a mantra from Transcendental Meditation, although usually reading The Course in Miracles workbook in the morning is my primary practice. But these days, all kinds of things. I read the Kabbalah right now, but those are the main things that I do.
Okay. Yeah, the morning practice is so crucial. You know, so many people.
It's so crucial. Because if you don't get to it in the morning, it's very, if you're that off the spiritual wagon by noon, it's really hard to get yourself back on, isn't it?
I tell people mornings are for affirmations, not information. You know, you really gotta affirm how you want the day to go. Not turn on the news first thing.
I say that all the time. Just good luck. If the first thing you do is go to Twitter and all that, particularly if you're running for president though, if that's the first, then, you know, good luck not being depressed by noon.
Sad but true. You actually have proposed something that I absolutely love. You call it the Department of Peace. What are some practical steps and policies for this department that you would implement?
I think a lot of people might not realize that peace building is an actual thing. So think of it like you think of health and sickness. Years ago, people thought they didn't really have to take care of their body. They didn't have to take care of their lifestyle. They didn't have to address issues of nutrition. And then if and when sickness arose, you just sought through external remedies to suppress or eradicate the symptoms. We have evolved beyond that. We realize we need to proactively create health, not just treat disease if and when it comes. So we need to think of peace and violence that way. You know, Martin Luther King said, there are two kinds of peace, negative peace and positive peace. He said, negative peace is where there's no outright violence, but there's underlying tension and anxiety. Positive peace, he said, can only be built on brotherhood and justice. So peace building means you preventatively create positions of peace. And you know that where there is too much, an unsustainable level of human despair, lack of human opportunity, you are actually fostering the conditions of violence. So the four main factors in proactive peace building or waging peace are the following. If these four factors are present in any situation, whether it's a corner of an American city or another part of the world, if these four factors are present, then there will be a higher incidence of peace and a lower incidence of violence. Number one, greater economic opportunities for women. Number two, greater educational opportunities for children. Number three, a reduction of violence against women. And number four, the amelioration of unnecessary human despair. So policies are, when you look at the billions that America has spent all around the world on, 800 military bases, if more than the tiny fraction that we have spent was built on helping people build wells in their villages, build schools, help women. It's called waging peace. right? We need to wage peace. So when you talk about specific policies, just like we have a military academy where we train people in how to wage war if we feel war is necessary, we should have a peace academy to teach people to wage peace. We need to imagine a world without war and imagine America's streets without violence, and then reverse engineer. For instance, I'll give you an example. Okay, we want to imagine an America at peace. Well, if you're going to really be sophisticated about that, you're going to say millions of American children go to schools where there aren't even the resources to teach every child in the school how to read. And if a child cannot learn to read by the age of 10, the chances of high school graduation are drastically decreased and the chances of incarceration are drastically increased. So in that sense, the educational policy is violent. The prison system is violence. The economic system. So we have so many policies that contribute to the festering of violence because desperate people become a national security risk. Desperate people become a petri dish out of which all manner of personal and societal dysfunction becomes almost inevitable, including vulnerability to ideological capture by genuinely psychotic forces. So to me, peace is not just a word, and it's also a verb. You wage peace. It's like love. It's something you do. We will have a violent society and a violent planet until we make a commitment to the nonviolent waging of peace. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm a pacifist and that I don't see there's ever any need for military action. Because just like with sickness, I'm not saying you wouldn't take medicine if medicine was necessary. I look at the military like I look at a surgeon. If you have to have surgery, you want to have the best. So if the United States needs surgery, you better believe we have the best. We need the best, and we should have the best surgeon on hand. But a reasonable person tries to avoid surgery. You try to avoid invasive measures if possible. And what we have, for all kinds of reasons, is a propensity to go directly for the allopathic, go directly for the bombs or the prisons. Well, that's not the way to heal or repair or even sustain your democracy or your species over time.
Mm. Waging peace. I love that one. That reminds me of Louise Hay. She had in one of her talks, she was saying, peace is breaking out all over the world.
I knew Louise.
She was a big proponent of visualizing the healing in countries. And I think it's powerful.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Her work during the AIDS crisis. Absolutely. Yeah. I knew Louise. There was something else you said. Oh, I was going to point out, you know, like you were talking about Roger Stone before. You know who said we need to learn to wage peace? You're going to love this one. You know who actually said that sentence? Donald Rumsfeld, who was George Bush's defense secretary, which is kind of shocking. I mean, many people said it before, you know, Gandhi and so forth, and Martin Luther King, all those, of course, nonviolence. But I thought it was pretty interesting that Donald Rumsfeld said we need to learn to wage peace.
An unlikely source.
And also, yeah. There was a line that Roosevelt wrote. This was in a speech that he did not live long enough to give, but he made a fascinating comment. He said, we need to do more than end war. We need to end the beginnings of all wars. And there is no more potent beginning of a war than desperate people, large groups of desperate people.
Marianne, these are so, for me, they're just so intuitive. Like these, it just makes so much sense. And sometimes I find myself being frustrated just thinking there must be smart people in government running the country that come up with these ideas, or maybe not, because we don't really see a Department of Peace. We don't really see these actions of taking preventative measures to prevent the diseases from even occurring.
I assure you, having been a candidate for the presidency twice now, the institutional resistance against such ideas is very great. Because actually solving the problems undercuts, in many cases, the economic interests of those who thrive and who prey upon those who have those problems. So if you read, you know, the corporate media, the corporatized political party machines and structures, I know just from the way they have sort of blacklisted me on mainstream media, and it's very intense. You know, we have this division between the problem solvers and the powerful. You're saying, well, don't they know about these solutions? Well, the problem solvers don't have the power, because those with the power too often don't really want to hear about the solutions. Because those solutions, although they will save our democracy, save our lives, save our species, don't necessarily produce short-term profits for the corporate puppet masters that are the donor class and that have turned our government into that system of legalized bribery. Interestingly enough, the deeply conservative Senator Josh Hawley, oddly enough, has called for the repeal of Citizens United. So that's kind of shocking. We're living at such an odd moment. Yeah. So I think that's one of the reasons there's such a moment of possibility here. People on the right as well as the left are realizing that your problem is not people on the left or on the right. The real axis today is the powerful versus the powerless. Those who have capital and more access to capital versus those who are just struggling to get by.
So it seems like to me the big domino in this situation would be to, which is what you're doing, is to wake people up to the love, to the oneness, because they're people, right? The powerful, we call it institutions, we have these names for it, but these are people with hearts that have gone through the same things that we've all gone through. So it seems like the most important work is to wake up the heart to the love that exists within all of us.
Well, I've had a 40-year career focused on just that, but I think we need to go beyond that right now, and I'll tell you why. This is why it's an inside-outside job. It's why Martin Luther King said, in order to establish the beloved community, we need external changes in our circumstances and internal shifts in our souls. So this is the deal. Not every rich person is a greedy bastard. Not every rich person lacks heart or love, and they might, in some cases, even on a personal level, be more generous and loving to their own children, right? You can't personalize this. It's the systems. It is the systems which we have to call to task. And that's a basic tenet of nonviolence. And for someone whose heart is at this point in my life and the journey I have taken, if I'm seeing somebody in a position of power, political power, and their heart is not open, and I might have known them for years, I'm not even interested in trying to open their heart at this point. I'm trying to defeat them at the ballot box, and someone else should sit there now.
It really comes down to that.
Yeah, and nobody has to convince me that the ultimate solution is a change of heart. But if we don't see that change of heart reflected in public policy...
There was really no change of heart.
Yeah, and you know, there's no religious or spiritual path that gives anyone a pass on addressing the suffering of other sentient beings.
So when you win, when you become president, who do you want as your VP?
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because there are several situations where there are people I would love to hire, but I don't want to say their name because I don't know what they think about me. There might be people that woman better not use my name. So I don't know. I was on the plane the other day, and there was a woman sitting next to me who's very high in the aviation industry. She was talking to me about, now, Secretary of Transportation. And then on that same trip, I was sitting next to somebody else on a plane who works in the State Department. We're talking, all right, now, Secretary of State, it's a fun game to play, but you have to be careful not to talk about people that might not want to be mentioned by you publicly. I will say this. I would want at my side someone who does know Washington and the mechanics of Washington. Now, though, I want to drive the car. But yeah, I do want a good political mechanic at my side.
Yeah. Awesome. Before you get out of here, I know you're under time crunch, but I want to play a quick game called The Five Bests. This is something that I ask everybody who comes on. It's a kind of a rapid fire game. So I'm going to ask you a question and give me a quick answer.
Okay.
Yeah. When was the best time in your life?
I should say the birth of my child, but it was a particular morning with a particular person, the moment, you know? big circumstance. Having a daughter, but that moment where I felt I was not alone.
What's the best book you've ever read? I think I know this one.
Well, The Course in Miracles has meant so much to me.
Best advice you've ever been given?
Get over yourself, Marianne. It's not about you.
Best quote you've ever heard?
Only love is real. Nothing else exists. Everything else is just evidence of the world. See through it to what's really going on here.
Mm. That's all you need right there. Best, and not necessarily financial, but best investment you've ever made.
Being a mother, putting myself into motherhood and career. And yeah, my career. You know, I've made certainly mistakes in my life, but the big pieces where I put my heart and soul, as in career and motherhood, even when I didn't get all the execution of it right, the fact that I was seeking to make the investment.
Marianne, if I was to give you a magic wand and you could wave this magic wand at the earth, and when you woke up tomorrow, your magic wand wish will be granted. What would your magic wand wish be?
Peace between the Israelis and Palestinians, which there was for so many centuries. Jews and Arabs got along for centuries. Both of them had more problem with Christianity than they had with each other for many centuries. And may this aberrational chapter of hostility be miraculously solved.
So it is. Marianne, what can people do listening that really resonated with you? Where can they go to support the campaign?
Thank you. They can go to marianne2024.com. That's Marianne, M-A-R-I-A-N-N-E, 2024.com. They can volunteer for the campaign, support us financially. I don't care how small it is. $3, $5, $10, or obviously more, anything that people can do to put their energy into it. That investment in the possibility of something that's a far more beautiful chapter of American history and the effort to make it happen. So, Marianne2024.com.
After we get off this call, I'm going to go support right now. So this was such a beautiful, beautiful conversation. I really applaud what you're doing, the heart, the love, the groundedness. Thank you for being you and just sharing and putting it all out there. You know, whatever happens with the result, I really appreciate the courage to go after it. And you have my support.
Thank you.